deliberately filmed being beaten by an employee. Jan Creamer from the Animal Defenders International thinks the sentence sends out the wrong message.
The Animal Welfare Act specifically has a section to make owners responsible for what happens to their animals. And what's been said by this court today is, don't worry if people are doing things to your animals that you don't know about. You don't need to really check on what happens with these animals.
An EU summit to agree Europe's budget for the next 7 years has been called off. Leaders of the 27 EU states abandoned efforts to agree a new multi-billion pound settlement after it became clear their positions were too far apart. At a news conference in Brussels, David Cameron says the deal being put forward just wasn't good enough for Britain.
Who's there to stand up for the taxpayer? Which institution in Europe is there, rather like the Treasury, to say, where's the money going to come from? Who's going to pay for this?
After the flooding that's hit many parts of the UK, more bad weather's on the way this weekend. In Somerset, a man died after getting trapped in his vehicle, which got wedged under a bridge last night. Unions say job losses in Wales confirmed by steel giant Tata will be devastating for the communities. The company plans to cut 900 jobs. Most of those losses will be in South Wales. Ministers are accusing council bosses of being massively out of step for claiming many people don't want their bins collected every week. The local government association says most people are happy with fortnightly collections. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us through this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Froom Vale, Leslie Alexander. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, after six, the BBC censoring whistleblowers, the very people who can tell us about corruption secretly banned from the BBC. We talk to former Uzbekistan ambassador, supporter of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and blogger Craig Murray. Plus, this week, students across the country have been demonstrating in London about debt and privatisation of our universities. We hear from the Bristol University crew. And the week before the Leveson inquiry comes out, we ask about close links between Lord Leveson himself and the Murdoch family, and also from Canadian Professor Anthony Hall about the too close relationship between the police and the media. And as ever, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots, including an incredible story of a military coup and coup plotters jailed from the eastern outpost of NATO, which has gone virtually unreported here in Britain. That's the Ergenekon plot in Turkey. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and dry this weekend, thank goodness. This weekend, highs of 7 Celsius, some heavy showers on Saturday, sunny on Sunday. That's the third weekend, I think, isn't it? We've had a showery Saturday and a sunny Sunday. Next week, highs of 9 Celsius, some heavy showers, particularly on Monday, and windy, becoming drier and brighter from midweek on. Next weekend, 1st and 2nd of December, highs only up to 1 degree Celsius, some sunshine, but also possibility of some snow. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guest, and it's Leslie Alexander from Froom Vale. Hi, Leslie, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, thank you.
Now, first of all, Leslie, what are your thoughts about the Bristol Mayor result? We've had actually not a very good result from the Conservatives in that election. Martin was saying last week he wanted the figures. We've got them now. George Ferguson won with 31,000. He was first. Second was Marvin Rees, Labour. Third was Jeff Gollop, 8,000 roughly. Fourth was John Rogers, Lib Dem, and fifth was Daniela Radici from the Green Party. She did very well, actually, very close to the Lib Dems, who are the ruling party in the city. So what do you think that the result has told us about the changing political makeup of Bristol?
Well, it certainly told us that people did not like the Lib Dem policies, and they wanted a change. And it also told us that they wanted they wanted an independent, because it was the same with the police commissioners. Wherever there was an independent standing, they seemed to come from nowhere to win.
No, I think it's a little bit unfair to talk about George Ferguson as purely as an independent, because I know up until just before the election he was a fully paid up member of the Liberal Democrat Party, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that the Liberal Democrats have switched their votes really from John Rogers, the official candidate, and last week we were hearing actually from a Liberal Democrat themselves that was Stephen Williams, the MP, that George Ferguson was the unofficial Liberal Democrat candidate. So do you think that's true?
No, they would say that, wouldn't they? No, I don't think so. But I do think that George, people did want an independent, and he took votes from all of the parties.
Now, also, there has been quite a lot of shenanigans this week, bring you in straight away, Martin, with the Labour Party, as to whether the Labour Party want to join George's cabinet. I mean, Labour came a very strong number two in the mayoral elections, with Marvin Rees getting 25,000 votes in the first round, as against George, well, actually nearer 26,000 against George's 31. And yet, Peter Hammond, leader of the Labour group, and the Labour group as a whole, was saying up until today, no, we don't want to take part in this cabinet. I mean, that sounds like sour grapes.
Well, I also understand, I'm talking on the hoof here, I understand that Helen Holland and Mark Bradshaw have decided to participate in the cabinet. Mm. Is that correct? Perhaps Leslie or...
No, it looks like that, yeah.
But
why this sour grapes to begin with, saying, we don't want to take part?
As I understand it, George Ferguson has offered Helen Holland and Mark Bradshaw seats in the cabinet as individuals, as members of the Labour Party, which they have accepted. The third seat is to be offered to the Labour Party, and they have to nominate somebody for him to consider. And inevitably, if the party's going to stay together, they've got to go away and have a chat with each other and decide what the party's position will be. I don't want to second guess that. But of course, if people are invited to join a cabinet and they decide to join, then they're in. So in a way, it's not clear whether Labour have finally decided not to participate or not. It's still not clear to me.
Isn't this really some kind of public spat because of the rivalry between the former leader Helen Holland and the now leader Peter Hammond? Peter really seeming to be one of the main people who was saying that there would be no participation by the Labour group, and now Helen has been made deputy mayor virtually. At least she's been offered that post now, and it looks like she'll accept it.
I think it's fair to say that offers of places in the cabinet, this is not a usual situation. In a normal situation, in a normal election, you just presume you're going to be the
opposition. Because you've got an independent in charge.
Well, exactly. So we're not playing by the normal rules. We're not in Kansas anymore. And I think there's inevitably going to be a debate within the Labour Party. It's going on in my head right now as I'm speaking to you. Is it a good idea to join this cabinet or not?
OK, what's the argument against it then?
Well, the argument against it is that in actual fact you then get implicated in all the decisions that are going to be taken, many of which are going to be very unpalatable. And it might be much more sensible for the Labour Party, this is the argument in favour of staying out, to be a kind of coherent opposition. You know, as you say, they came second in the vote in a general election with a turnout more like 60 or 70% instead of 30%. It's clearly the passive Labour vote which hasn't voted, which lost the election for us. But in a general election, that's a different story, and in 4 years' time it might be a different story, especially if you've stood on the outside and just criticised. That's the argument against. The argument for is that in actual fact, whoever won, you're going to have a very limited set of options, and having everybody on board in Bristol across the parties might be a refreshing change which could make everybody think about politics differently. Now, that's a big question for the Labour Party to ask itself, but I think it's absolutely legitimate to decide either way. I mean, you might decide that the best thing to do is just stay outside and be honest and just oppose, or you might decide, well, in actual fact, what's best for us and best for the city is to participate. But you can see there are arguments on both sides.
Yeah, Leslie, I wonder about this whole business of the mayor being a bit of a poison chalice as well, because everyone was getting excited about, we're going to have a mayor who's now going to have a lot more power. It's going to be independent, supposedly, even though it's an ex-Lib Dem. But we're in a situation now, aren't we? We've elected a mayor, but the first task is £25 million worth of cuts. I mean, surely that's a poison chalice.
It is indeed. I would have thought that he's going to have to do that, and I don't know if you saw the papers yesterday, but that was one of the big things amongst those people that didn't support a mayor, that there was going to be cuts, and the first thing that George would do would be that he would cut. But
he calls it savings, doesn't he?
Yes, he calls it savings, and... Well, Why not?
Martin, what are your thoughts about these cuts? I know you're very against the idea of cutting. Is there anything practical George can do? Because he does have, we're told, he's going to have the ear of the Prime Minister now. He's going to be able to go up to Downing Street and bang his fist on the table in a way that previous leaders in Bristol weren't able to do and demand changes.
Well, it may be, if you've got an all-party cabinet in Bristol, that strengthens the negotiating position of the city vis-a-vis central government. On the other hand, it may be that the policies being pursued by central government are so pernicious, and in fact I believe they are pernicious, that there's quite a strong argument for just not walking by on the other side of the road and allowing what you might call the bourgeois parties to go forward with their cuts policy, which is in fact wrong. You shouldn't be cutting public expenditure in Bristol or anywhere else in Britain at this stage.
Martin,
that's not an argument we've won yet inside the Labour.
It's very, very easy for you to say that, but where's the money going to come from?
The money is going to, the problem we've got is that the deficit is increasing as a result of the cuts policy, and that will become increasingly clear as we go forward. There is no case for cutting public expenditure in Britain at this stage. Inside the Eurozone, they've got to because of the European pacts that they've signed up to. Now, they shouldn't be doing it there either. In actual fact, the policy being pursued by all major parties at local and national level is in the pocket of the City of London and the bankers, and that is a fundamental problem for democracy.
So how are you going to deal with that?
Well, you either decide to go participate and get your hands dirty and try and mitigate the circumstances, or you take the more purist position of we're going to stand aside from this and watch it all crash. I personally think it's fairly clear that we can't just stand aside. We'll have to be participant in the running of the council. But on the other hand, you can see why that doesn't sit very well with the analysis that I have, which is that cutting public expenditure locally and nationally is simply wrong.
Leslie, a Conservative Party, your party is having a bit of a heart attack again over Europe. It just seems to happen every once in a while, doesn't it? Periodically. What's your view on the negotiations that are happening now with the euro? Are you a pro in the EU? I mean, they're now saying, look, if you don't go along with this, Dave, you may be out of Europe. You may be kicked out of the European Union. You may no longer be part. I mean, surely maybe you could just tell us what your how the party here in Bristol views all that and what your own views are.
Well, the party here in Bristol, I don't know that I can speak for them particularly. I think that the main view, and it's certainly my view, is that we joined the as when it was a common market for the trading, and it's gone too far. I really don't want to be providing the levels of money that are being demanded of us, and the interference in what should be our government's decisions.
Yeah, there's a bit of a dilemma, isn't there? We have to decide at some point, is it Westminster that's making the big decisions, Martin, or is it Brussels?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I see all of these kind of arguments, and you're going to have similar arguments about whether Scotland should be independent of Westminster, for example, or Catalonia independent of Madrid.
Or Cardiff.
Or the Basque region independent of
yeah, or Cardiff, even closer, yeah.
Well, these kind of arguments intensify at times when the pie is shrinking. Arguments between centres and peripheries, between different social groups with different social attitudes, intensify and become more entrenched and intractable. And, you know, you can see a kind of rerun of the 1930s in slow motion going on here, right across Europe, and right here in front of our faces. And trying to find consensus politics, which we might be trying to do in the city by having all major forces on one cabinet, would be an interesting experiment, but one that could also end in failure and then actually really undermine people's faith in any kind of democracy.
Back to the mayor debate for a minute, and I think one of the most surprising figures, really, if you look at the existing makeup of the councillors in the city, with the Greens only having two councillors, Daniela Radice did it remarkably well, coming fifth, really, just behind John Rogers for the Liberal Democrat Party. What does that tell you about the sort of mood of the city, do you think, Leslie?
They want either independent. They're fed up with the three main parties, basically. So they're looking at either independent, and yes, we've already discussed whether George is really independent or whether he's a lapsed Liberal, but he stood as an independent, and that's what a lot of people don't even realise, he was a Liberal. And the Green Party, they're not part of the mainstream at the moment, and so therefore they probably would pick
almost
up votes when people are disaffected.
Almost a protest vote, Martin,
it
you
is,
think?
Yeah.
Well, I think if we, for the sake of argument, accept that votes for George Ferguson were potential Liberal voters, which they didn't get, what I think we've got in Bristol is a fairly good reflection of the political spectrum in Britain as a whole, which is actually more complex than just Labour versus Tory, even though it's Labour and Tory who are sitting at this table now. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what's interesting. We've got to try and make our political process fit for purpose. It's a bit like the changes in the rules of rugby union in the 1980s to make the game faster, to allow different kinds of ways of playing. And I think that what this mayoral election with a one single transfer has shown is that given a choice, people will spread out and take some choices. And then on the back of that, you've then got to build coalitions. Now, this is actually normal politics in the rest of Europe. It's not normal politics in Britain, where it's Yabu sucks, it's all or nothing 100%. But in most of the rest of Europe, most of the time, there's a bigger variety of parties, but then coalitions have to be formed, just normal stuff.
OK, now the other big election, of course, was for the Police and Crime Commissioner, something that many people, both inside and outside the police, were against. But with the new person who's been elected, that was Sue Mount-Stevens, the independent candidate again. And here she is with her acceptance oath. She had to swear an oath to get into her job.
I, Sue Mount-Stevens of North Somerset, do hereby declare that I accept the office of Police and Crime Commissioner for Avon and Somerset. In making this declaration, I solemnly and sincerely promise that during my term of office, I will serve all the people of Avon and Somerset in the office of Police and Crime Commissioner. I will act with integrity and diligence in my role and to the best of my ability. Will execute the duties of my office to ensure that the police are able to cut crime and protect the public. I will give a voice to the public, especially victims of crime, and work with other services to ensure the safety of the community and effective criminal justice. I will take all steps within my power to ensure transparency of my decisions so that I may be properly held to account by the public. I will not interfere with the operational independence of police officers. And I accept all of these terms to become Avon Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner.
That was Sue Mount-Stevens earlier this week accepting her job as a Police and Crime Commissioner. I'm not quite sure what would have happened if she hadn't read the oath exactly as she was supposed to have. We probably have no Police and Crime Commissioner. But anyway, Leslie, immediate fallout this week, where yesterday we had the announcement of the effective resignation of the Chief Constable, who said he would not be standing. What are your thoughts about that particular outcome?
Well, I've only very briefly picked it up. It rather sounds as if the new police commissioner is flexing her muscles and has decided that she might not necessarily want Colin in post, although she's saying nice things about him. It does sound as if she is, as if she's starting the way she means to go on, and she wants somebody else, or she wants to look at who might apply for the post.
Yes, Martin, Colin Porter sounds a little bit sort of curmudgeonly in his reply. He says at 9:13 a.m. yesterday morning he released a statement which includes the lines, "Yesterday I had a meeting with the Police and Crime Commissioner. She told me she intends to start the process to recruit a Chief Constable to take Avon and Somerset forward. I told her I had no intention of applying for my own job."
Well, yes, I mean, it's further disruption and chaos. And, of course, during the Cultural Revolution in China, the Maoists thought that more chaos the better, because in actual fact you need to shake everything up, and then once you shake everything up, the pieces fall together in a different way, and it's all a new, brave new world. I just see chaos, I'm afraid. There should never have been a police commissioner election. Sue Mount-Stevens is a perfectly nice person, but she's got no mandate. And
well, she has. She's got a massive public mandate now. She has.
What percentage of the electorate voted for Mrs. Mount-Stevens?
Ah, she was... everybody could have voted.
But of the electorate as a whole, because I spoilt my ballot and lots of people refused to participate, like my parents, for example.
But you can't say she's got no mandate.
No, she has got no mandate for this, for being a police commissioner. A police commissioner has got to have an overwhelming mandate to remove a serving police officer like that. But she hasn't actually... That's basically the only thing she can do.
She hasn't removed him.
No, he's removed himself.
She hasn't removed him.
I was quite happy to see him.
Let's just be clear.
I've got my own bones to pick with
him. Let's just be clear about this, because his contract runs out at the beginning of next year anyway.
Yes.
And it's just what she's doing, I think, is fairly sensible. She's saying, let's make sure we're ahead of the game when it comes to recruiting someone to replace him. But he's saying, effectively, look, I'm not going to be reapplying for my own job, which could only have lasted until January anyway.
This is all very well. Mrs. Mount Stevens is acting quite within the rules as they stand, and she's flexing her muscles, as Leslie so rightly says. But in actual fact, I don't think the people at large want this kind of politicisation of the role of Chief Constable. If we're talking about the role of Chief Constable, and this particular Chief Constable, not very happy with what happened in the riots in Stokes Croft 2 years ago, totally provocative policing, and many of us blame Colin Port for that. In fact, we suspect he may have been collaborating with Tesco's. Now, if people don't like to hear that kind of talk, then don't politicise the police force. If we'd had an election in Northern Ireland, we'd be choosing whether we wanted a loyalist running the police force or a Republican running the police force. Don't the Tory government understand the danger of going down that road? Next time there's a major riot in Bristol, we're going to be politicising every aspect of it. No crying for mummies when we get there.
But Martin, the electorate and Sue Mount Stevens have both said, basically, we don't want to politicise it. Leslie, what are your thoughts about the selection of Sue by the public and her first week? Well, actually, I think she only started yesterday, her first few days in the job. A bit rocky already.
It is rocky already, and good luck to her. But she was elected, and she was fairly and squarely elected. If people didn't vote for her, then I'm afraid that was their problem and not hers. But they had the opportunity to vote, and they chose not to use it. So I think she's just making her statement and going on as she means to.
Yeah, Martin, I'm going to challenge you on this, because ultimately, once people have decided they want a commissioner, it's almost like you can't. You're not actually holding up any kind of light, are you? You're not saying this is the way things should be. You just don't like them the way they are. There is no going back to the old police authority. That's over now. Sue is now in charge. Don't you think it really you should be supporting her now? She's got the majority of votes right across the area.
Ultimately, we're going to get a national Labour government, which is going to abolish police commissioners. That's all I'm interested in.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you don't have to. Games you don't want to participate in, you don't have to participate in. The mandate of Mrs. Mount Stevens simply doesn't exist. And of course, she can carry on being paid whatever she's going to be paid, several hundred thousand pounds. Serving police officers have been on this show saying that money could have been better spent. I agree with them. She's got to start off with the fact that no senior police officer or beat officers are in any way in favour of having a police commissioner. I've spoken to officers in the last week. They're absolutely appalled by the whole idea. She's got a mountain to climb of credibility with those people.
What percentage of the vote does it start to become something that Martin will accept?
I think it's 50% plus one when Scotland wanted independence, isn't it? But we've actually got a mayor now on the back of a 25% turnout.
But that's of the turnout, Martin.
Yes, but the turnout is everything.
If people don't want to vote, they don't have to vote.
All right, so the next time the RMT has a strike where only 20% of the people vote to strike, and they call everybody out on strike on the back, the 80% could have voted, they didn't choose to vote, but the RMT executive now says there's a national strike, you didn't bother to vote, you're out on strike, or you lose your RMT membership, which means you lose your right to work on the railway. Let's go back to the good old days where the people who vote, the ones who can be bothered, decide everything. Oh yes, that's how we run the trade unions, isn't it?
But
that's
how we used to run. It is actually. I mean, if people don't vote, that is that then they don't participate in an election.
The NUM
that's
rules,
the end of the show. Let's just have Leslie's view on this.
Sorry, I'm now confused on whether I'm commenting.
Well, no.
What mandate you need in terms of participation? Yeah. Yeah?
Yes, but don't forget, her mandate is only for 4 years, and then there is an election. So if we don't like what she is doing, then we can get rid of her. But there is more scrutiny of that role than there ever is in, for instance, the police chief in America. And as for the salary that she is supposedly going to get, it's about in the region of 90,000, I believe. It's certainly not hundreds of thousands.
Anyway, we had a bit of a tit-for-tat exchange between the Chief Constable and the new Commissioner, and Martin's joined in as well. Anyway, our next story, Peter Wood, the Bristol City Council, has contacted me about election expenses, because I think this may possibly be an issue. I was picking a bit of a bone last week about wondering how much money had been spent by the various campaigns. I myself got either three, or I think it was four or even five mail shots from George Ferguson, and yet from the Labour Party candidate and from the Conservative candidate, only one mail shot. So I'm really questioning this whole business of the amount of money spent on mail shots and public relations. So what are your thoughts about this? Because, I mean, of course, the US system is that you can spend what you want on an election.
There are limits. I don't, if I'm honest, know exactly what the limit was.
Well, I can tell you, this is Peter's, Peter Wood from Bristol City Council explained that it's £21,000 maximum can be spent on the election, and any payment over £50 has to be itemised. All those expenses will be submitted by all candidates who stood in the mayoral election by Thursday the 20th of December. So we'll obviously be revisiting that when those expenses are in.
Yes.
But what are your thoughts about the money, amounts of money spent by the various parties and by George Ferguson on the election?
Well, parties can spend what they want to. I wish we had quite the sort of money, and I suspect that most of the parties would feel the same, that they had endless funds on that one. I mean, we combined the mayoral election with the PC election on our leaflets here in Bristol. In areas outside of Bristol, then one half was for the local MP or councillors, whatever they decided. In some areas, we put out three pieces of paper. In others, it was less. It just depended on the delivery structure and the areas that we were covering.
Well, Martin, what's your thoughts about the limits? Because obviously this is, if there is, if there are problems and discrepancies with the
expenses. George's expenses will be very carefully scrutinised. You don't need to. You don't need anybody else other than the parties.
No, I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. But the other question here is the time period as well, because George, for example, started back in the, you know, sort of early summer, late spring. The first leaflets were coming through the door, and certainly, as far as I have been able to work out, that the amount spent starts at the close of nominations.
Yes.
When the actual that's where the amount of spending is starts to be scrutinised.
Yes, I mean, I think as we see in the US, the amount of money spent on elections just goes up and up and up and up, and the quality of the debate goes down and down and down. In Scandinavia, for a generation now, all political parties are funded by the state. And of course, in Britain, everybody goes, oh, you couldn't possibly do that. But there's a reason why Norway, occupied by the Germans, instituted a system where each party gets basically the funds that it deserves according to its electoral support. Ultimately, I would see a system like that working for Britain. I don't think there's been too many problems with expenses in this case. I mean, we all know that George Ferguson is a millionaire. I got him to admit it on a platform during the campaign. But he's, as Leslie says, his expenses have got to be within electoral law, otherwise people will cry foul.
And all the other parties will be going over it all with a fine-tooth comb.
Don't worry. Everybody will watch everybody else's expenses, very much so. But, yes, it starts when the election campaign proper starts after the close of nominations. If George got Literature out before that, then he's entitled to do so, the same as any of the other parties. And I mean, I suspect we all did that.
Things like it does make a bit of a mockery of it if everybody's doing the same thing, spending money before the deadline.
Well, it's the same with the council elections. You campaign all through the year, hoping to mop up in May, but it's only the stuff that actually goes out after the election that it counts towards the expenses.
Okay, on to our next story. And last night's question time was a bit fiery. We had a guy called Owen Jones having a bit of a spat with Ian Duncan Smith. And bizarrely, even though, of course, he's a cabinet minister, Ian Duncan Smith, the question aimed at him was left by David Dimbleby and the production team at Question Time to the very, very last minute. And so we were left with a situation where, just as things were starting to get very interesting, Dimbleby had to step in and close the programme down. So let's have a listen now to just the last couple of minutes of Question Time, where there were some real sparks flying.
Most new claimants of housing benefit are in work. They don't have enough money to pay extortionate rents. If we built housing in this country, we'd bring down the welfare bill, stimulate the economy and create jobs. But there is a point as well that has to be made about the treatment of disabled people in this country. And there are two names I just want to give Ian. And if there's anything he remembers, it's this. Brian McArdle, 57 years old, paralysed down one side, blind in one eye, he couldn't speak. He died one day after being found Fit for Work by ATOS. Another example, Karen Sherlock.
Hang on a second, we've heard a lot from you. Let me tell you something. I didn't hear you screaming about 2.5 million people who are parked, nobody saw them for over 10 years, not working, with no hope, no aspiration. We are changing their lives. I'm proud of doing that. Getting them off benefit is what we're going to do.
1,100 people.
All right, that's it. I'm afraid our time's up. Apologies. No, I know I can see you want to speak, but we've got to stop because our hour is up, and that is the story of Question Time. We always have to stop when things are just getting going.
Yes, that was the very end of Question Time last night. What about you first on this, Leslie? Because it's a bit of a serious problem, isn't it, this business with ATOS? A lot of disabled people actually living in fear, some of them who are literally, I mean, for example, one person there who can't speak, being told, well, you're fit for work, you've got to go out and find a job. Just on the same week as we hear, for example, the Bristol Ferry Boat Company has collapsed. We've had all the massive network of 7 or so steel plants in Wales. They are being closed. There's something like 900 jobs going in Wales. So just as the jobs are becoming almost impossible to get, people who are disabled are being told you've got to go out and get them.
Well, yes, whether or not they can actually get a job is another matter. A lot of disabled people actually want to work, but they need a little bit of help to get into the job market.
Well, for example, with Remploy, where they were given a little bit of help, and those were jobs which were specifically slightly subsidised in order to employ people at Remploy. Now, the government, one half of the government, has said, "Oh well, we can't be bothered to spend that. We're not going to spend that money on Remploy," which just simply means that the people who used to work there are now on full benefits rather than a small subsidy. They're now getting a massive subsidy from the taxpayer.
Yes, I take your point. I don't know the full story on Remploy, I'm afraid.
What about the larger question over the which Owen mentioned there briefly, Owen Jones from The Independent, The Columnist, which is the sort of shifting of blame away from the banks, the big city, powerful city institutions, who we have Boris Johnson, Conservative Mayor of London, this week saying, you know, I'm your man, I will look after you guys in the city. These people making a mess of the economy, and yet the people who are paying the price are some of the weakest in the whole of our society.
The banks didn't cover themselves with credit, I have to say, but I also think that they are being made a scapegoat for some of the things that the last government did. No, they're not perfect, but they the fact that they were able to do what they did do was because they weren't being regulated properly, and that, I'm afraid, was down to Gordon Brown.
Martin, article in the New Statesman earlier this year, how many more disabled people will die, frightened their benefits will be taken away. Karen Sherlock, who it was alluded to on Question Time, but he didn't get a chance to really talk about, she faced endless pressure, the judgment of society, the fear of destitution, exhaustion of constant assessments and endless forms, all as she battled to survive. She was a disability campaigner. So, you know, what about her?
Well, I think the fact is, I accept that Ian Duncan Smith is genuine in his desire to help those less fortunate than himself, but I don't think he understands how the benefit system works or what the purpose of the benefit system is. In actual fact, what you need to do if you're going to have a crash restructuring of the economy, which is what they claim they want, it's pretty silly, but let's say you're going to do that, we're going to switch off the money tap and then everything will be restructured like in the 1980s. In that situation, you've actually got to make the benefit system more user-friendly, not less user-friendly. And of course, this is a misjudgment from the suburbs of what goes on in inner city life. I'm afraid that although many people in the current government mean well, they are disconnected from the realities on the ground in Britain, and also they've basically misunderstood their economics. The deficit is actually increasing, and as we go forward into further cuts in public services, the deficit will get bigger. It did in the 1980s. If they go back and look at the history of the 1980s and the early 1980s, the Howe budgets and so on, they will find that the deficit didn't come down. British industry was completely restructured. The unions had their back broken. That was the purpose of the whole exercise. But the deficit didn't come down until they started spending money again. And of course, what will happen very soon, before Christmas or into the new year, is we're going to hit the brick wall. And at that point, even the middle class will
wake up.
But
look, can we get down to brass tacks here, which was what Owen was trying to do on Question Time, and talk about individuals, blind, deaf tube-fed, non-verbal, disabled man deemed fit to work by the Department of Work and Pensions and ATOS, or Jan Morgan, unable to look after herself after a severe stroke, and yet also told that she then has to seek work, and many others. I mean, Karen, who he briefly mentioned there, Karen Sherlock, she was extremely unwell. Her medical conditions were diabetic, autonomic neuropathy, which is gastric, causing unpredictable and severe diarrhea, gastroparesis, causing unpredictable and severe bouts of vomiting, diabetic retinopathy, partially sighted, loss of peripheral vision in both eyes, some central vision in her left eye. She had a heart condition, chronic kidney disease, vitamin B12 deficiency, anemia, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, underactive thyroid, chronic tiredness due to a combination of multiple medical conditions, and asthma. She is considered fit for work.
Well, all I can say is ATOS are not doctors, which is pretty obvious, but they're being put in charge of deciding whether people are fit for work. I think the government deciding that ATOS, who are not doctors, are to decide who's fit for work, I suggest that the government are not fit to rule.
Leslie, that's a pretty sharp charge from Martin, but I mean, you can see where he's coming from. ATOS are basically making their money from removing people from benefits. They're not actually making a proper medical assessment, are they?
I can understand Martin's comments on that one, because it does sound absolutely dire. You have a look at the... I mean, there's an appeal system, so she can appeal. It rather looks in this case as if somebody's opened the medical dictionary and just listed everything that is there. That is amazing. But if those things really are wrong with her, then obviously she's got to appeal, and presumably...
But isn't this the problem? It's not actually doctors who are doing these assessments. The people who are doing the assessments are being paid to remove people from benefits. There's something sort of perverse about that.
They're not removing them from benefits. They're shifting them from one benefit to another benefit.
All right, removing them from disability benefits.
The whole idea of all the changes is to simplify the benefit system, which is what you were calling for just now, to have a simplified benefit system.
I would flag up some sort of little bit of hope here, which is this thing called the Black Triangle campaign, which examines the private firm's role in the creation of the disability assessment regime. That is to say, this assessment regime has actually been, rather than been drawn up by the government, been drawn up by people like ATOS, who've then pitched it to the government. So if anyone is interested in legal ways that you can challenge even the fact that you're being forced to have an assessment, do look up online the Black Triangle campaign, because they've gone through a lot of the law to do with benefits and assessments, and if you can show various things to do with your condition, you can prove that, then you don't have to have an assessment. So I would definitely recommend that Black Triangle campaign to anyone that's in fear. Obviously you have to be ill as well, but if you are and you're really in fear of losing an essential benefit, then and check that one out. Next story anyway is housing benefit changes could force 11,000 disabled people out of their homes. Another disabled story. This is also from a bit further back in the year, but again related to that question time, because Owen Jones mentioned the figure of 11,000, and this is obviously what he's referring to. Housing benefit changes forcing 11,000 disabled people out of homes. Now, who's saying this? Well, it's the crisis charity, the people who do the crisis over Christmas, the Christmas places for homeless people. Leslie, now that's pretty shocking too, isn't it? I mean, this adds up to quite an assault on disabled people.
If it is true, then it is a problem. But I cannot believe that 11,000 disabled people are going to lose their homes.
Well, certainly there are threats. The homeless charity Crisis said the government's own figures shows that almost one in five of the 62,500 people in England, Scotland and Wales affected by the proposed extension of the shared accommodation rate have a disability. From the 1st of January 2012, single people aged 25 to 34 will only be able to claim housing benefit based on the cost of a room in a shared house, rather than a modest one-bed flat, bringing them into line with existing rates for people under 25. So effectively what they're saying is you have to move out of a one-bed flat and into a shared house even if you're disabled.
I suspect if discussions that I have all the time with the housing department at Bristol City Council, if you were a new applicant, then yes, you would probably have to have a shared house rather than a flat. But if you've already got a flat, I don't think they're going to move you out.
But Martin, one of the things this is doing is this will save quite a lot of money. According to the equality impact assessment carried out by the Department for Work and Pensions, Ian Duncan Smith's department, the average loss per week to these disabled people will be 41 £21, rising to £45 a week in the South East and £87 a week in London. The highest losses will be incurred by young people renting in Camden in London, £116 a week that they're going to be losing. Certainly a lot of young people, a lot of disabled people look to they're going to have to move ultimately, aren't they?
Yes, and also possibly move away from where there is work, for example. So lots of people are being decanted from inner London to Bournemouth, and I understand the Tory council there are very unhappy about it, but there you go. Are they going to find jobs in Bournemouth? Well, we'll see. I mean, the problem is the housing benefit bill. The housing benefit bill is out of control because for a generation, including under New Labour, we didn't do enough about social housing, or dare I say it, council housing in this country. In the 1950s, when Harold Macmillan was Prime Minister, he was the Prime Minister who built the most council houses. That was when Britain was properly run, where we weren't run on property bubbles and everybody sitting around at dinner parties going on about their house prices rising. In Germany, house prices haven't risen by anything at all in 40 years. And when people sit around at dinner tables, they talk about what their firms are doing, what new industries they're creating. What the problem with Britain is that what we need to do to break out of the crisis we're in is not cut public expenditure, it's a massive investment in social housing for people on low incomes, which flexibilises the labour market, means you can cut wage levels can come down and people can actually live in dignity.
Martin, the reason that we've got a shortage of housing surely is largely to do with immigration. If we just allowed global immigration, that is from Commonwealth countries and also Eastern European immigration, a lot of these people are just simply economic migrants driving down the price of labour.
Well,
the cost of
there
labour.
There is an issue about movement of labour all over the world, not just in Britain. Look at the United States. They're not in the EU, but they're being swamped by immigrants from Mexico, supposedly. In actual fact, modern countries have to manage immigration and all these other things by having a long-term rational plan.
Well, they haven't had
that.
In
places like Norway, poor people get decent places to live, including the immigrants. And in actual fact, Norway's the most successful economy, not just in Europe, but in the world. And it's not run by free marketeers.
Leslie, this is what about this housing benefit bill? Martin's point there is pretty good, isn't it? That ultimately we're paying far more than we should be for our housing because there's such a shortage.
There is a shortage of housing, but as you rightly point out, quite a lot of it is down to immigration because we can work out what we need by the birth rate and that sort of thing. What we can't work out is the immigration population coming in. That is a finger in the wind job, and unfortunately it is causing a problem.
Well, why is it? I mean, ever since the Thatcher years, the Conservative Thatcher years, we've stopped building social housing. When there's housing associations doing it nowadays, but that was really the end of building council housing and cheap housing for people.
But the social housing do get grants to enable them to do that. And Bristol doesn't build any council housing, but it's looking at all its sites, its garage sites and all sorts of sites, to offer to housing associations for them to build housing.
But the central government, Leslie, the central government is actually cutting back quite a lot on the grants that they're giving to housing associations to build. So at the same time as we're desperately needing more homes, we're getting less built.
And it's not the cheap way to do it either. If you don't invest for decent housing for low-income people, your housing benefit bill ends up bankrupting you. And this is one of the reasons why the deficit is increasing. Because you can't just cut deficits. If you could just cut deficits, it would be easy.
Okay, on to the next story. And I mentioned it briefly earlier on. The steel giant Tata is to cut 900 British jobs. This is from the Telegraph, I think. Tata is cutting 900 jobs and closing 12 sites under plans to improve competitiveness, the company has announced today. Most of the job losses will be in South Wales, including 500 at Port Talbot, and under restructuring of management and administrative posts, a total of 580 jobs will be cut in Wales, 155 in Yorkshire, 120 in the West Midlands and 30 on Teesside. Sites to close include Teffmwrbach and Clos Keys in South Wales, and I'm not going to try and pronounce all the other ones up north. But anyway, ultimately, Leslie, this is a disaster, isn't it? This is one of the most important industries in any kind of industrial country, steel, and basically it's going through the floor. In fact, at the bottom of the article, it says quietly, just the last but one paragraph, this announcement comes after a four-year-long downturn in the UK, Tata and European steel industry, where the fall in UK steel demand has been steeper than any other major European economy. So that's a pretty good indication that Britain is doing far worse than many of its European neighbours.
Well, it certainly seems to be doing so in steel. But I think in a lot of other things that we're creating jobs, the private sector is creating jobs. I know some of them are part-time jobs, but they are going the right way.
Martin. What does this tell us, the steel industry? It's a pretty good indicator, isn't it, of, you know, things like construction, that kind of thing.
It's a straw in the wind, and it's not just Britain that's having a potential depression here. I mean, the whole world is teetering on the brink of potential collapse, I have to say it. I think the jobs that are being created, insofar as they have been created, as Leslie says, they're not high-quality jobs. They're short-term. They tend to be low-wage. The thing about manufacturing jobs is that they are high-wage for relatively low skill. Service industry jobs are low-skill and low-waged. I'm afraid I can't see the unemployment picture remaining as relatively buoyant as it has been. I think that we're actually going to have a fairly major shock in international markets sometime fairly soon. Britain won't be the only people affected, but Britain is going to be particularly affected because of the basically, I regard, masochistic stance of British central government. I think in actual fact the deficit won't be brought down according to the target set by the coalition, but that actually won't be a disaster as they pretend. It'll basically be what should have happened anyway.
So, Martin, do you think if David Cameron was playing ball with Angela Merkel in Brussels at the moment, or wherever it is they're having these negotiations this time, that we wouldn't be seeing such a terrible figure for the steel plants?
They're negotiating about the EU budget, which is another topic altogether. Basically, the pressure on budgets everywhere is basically leading to demand being sucked out of the economy everywhere, which will ultimately lead to the banks collapsing. The banks basically are bankrupt, and they're being kept afloat on taxpayer money. So all this money that's supposedly going on, disabled social housing tenants, a lot of it, basically the money that's been given to the banks is not accounted as part of the public sector borrowing requirement, because we're going to get it back, apparently, when the banks are privatised. But in actual fact, it's a black hole, far bigger black hole than the Welsh steel industry ever was. But at what point are we going to pull the plug on the City of London and say, actually, this is like a Welsh mine, which has not no coal in it anymore. How much money is a taxpayer going to throw down this hole? And the answer ultimately will be, we can't throw money down the hole. At that point, the banks will collapse. And Britain will take a particular hit, because the City of London is the heart of darkness for this whole thing globally.
Martin, you're always speaking doom about the city.
I'm afraid I am.
Leslie, I don't know if you've been watching this this political thriller series that's been on Wednesday evenings called Secret State. But they had a kind of situation in there where one of these big corporate banks that are actually owned by the public starts messing around with the government and telling the government what to do, saying, oh well, you can't seize these assets, we've just moved them out of the country, ha ha. And do you think that there is a sort of power play going on between government, the people we represent to represent us in Westminster, and the powerful city institutions, and if so, who's wearing the trousers? Who's in charge? Is it the city, or is it David Cameron and the cabinet?
I think probably you've been watching too much of that programme, and it is a story.
So are you saying that the Mr Cameron and the cabinet are really in charge?
Yes, I think so.
Martin?
I'm afraid not, and it would be the same would be true of the Labour cabinet. They wouldn't necessarily be in charge either. I'm afraid the situation has got so bad now that the banking system is so overburdened with debt that the governments are placed in a position where they've got to basically do as they're told if they want to prevent a crash. But ultimately a crash will happen, and on the other side of the crash we'll talk about the kind of society we want to live in. And more positively, the whole thing about having a universal benefit, that could be a positive suggestion, provided it's provided without conditions to everybody.
And maybe that disabled people get a proper amount for disabled people rather than get told you've got to look for a job.
We've got to start thinking about people and less about profit. Profits a second.
I think there's something pretty hideous, almost fascist, about telling a disabled person who can hardly speak to go and look for a job in a market where there are hardly any jobs. Anyway, let's move on to say something a little bit more positive about the city. UBS rogue trader Kweku Adeboli is jailed for 7 years. A jury convicts Adeboli of 2 counts of fraud in relation to 1.5 billion trading loss at one of the world's best known banks. Leslie, at last it seems that some of these city traders are paying for their crimes.
Absolutely. But he's not the first one to pay for his crime. There was one quite some time ago, I can't remember his name now. But yes, I mean, if you defraud your bank to the point of almost collapse, you deserve to be sent to jail. 7 years seems quite reasonable.
Martin, in his case, he was saying that there was this thing called the Umbrella, which was a sort of dodgy kind of slush fund. Giving evidence, Adeboli insisted his colleagues knew about the Umbrella, an account supported in part by emails and electronic chats with fellow traders, said UBS bosses placed him under enormous pressure to increase profits, whatever the means.
I think the problem is that what may be happening here is we're picking a fairly lowly level scapegoat out, and it's a systemic problem. People are systemically taking the wrong positions, and malinvestment is taking place, to use the Hayekian phrase.
What does that mean?
Well, basically, malinvestment means where projects are put in train, you know, building skyscrapers or whatever, which are never going to come to fruition, and ultimately, this is what causes crashes because of malinvestment or maldirection of capital. I'm afraid that we've actually had a huge bubble of malinvestment, and the market solution for that is a crash. And I don't hear many people in the mainstream putting forward the free market solution, which is not a penny for bankrupt institutions, whether they are car industries, steel mills, or banks. But of course, the danger with that is that capitalism collapses, and that really means people lose their savings, including the wealthy classes, and then we start again on a clean
market. I mean, for anyone that's interested in that, it's certainly worth looking. In 2000 in Argentina, a very similar thing happened with a complete breakdown of the banking system in Argentina. People who'd saved for years and years went to the cash points, went to their banks to find them completely closed. In fact, there's a painting, isn't there, in Bristol City Art Gallery by, I can't remember, Rowena something or other, who's a famous Bristol painter, called The Stoppage of the Bank. If you go up to the art gallery at the top of Park Street, you'll see it. Yeah. And this is from the 1800s, a picture showing what it's like for people when they go to get their money out of the bank and it's simply closed. Now, okay, so that was from 120, 30 years ago, but it could happen today, Leslie, surely.
Well, I didn't think it could until recently, and I suppose, yes, until...
Well, with Northern Rock, you know.
Until Northern Rock started the rot, yes.
Now, next story, Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson to face fresh charges. This is another load of charges which were announced this week on the former editor of the News of the World and also to the Prime Minister David Cameron's former press secretary, Andy Coulson. Scandal involving alleged criminality of Rupert Murdoch's British tabloids grew on Tuesday as prosecutors brought the first charges against a journalist employed by The Sun and also brought fresh charges against the media mogul's most senior lieutenants. Rebecca Brooks was charged over an alleged conspiracy to make illegal payments, that is, bribes to you and me, to a public official whilst working as editor of The Sun. Also charged was the paper's chief reporter, John Kay, both alleged to have been involved in a conspiracy to pay £100,000 over 7 years to a defence ministry official. Martin, this is pretty serious stuff, isn't it? And basically, the News of the World newsrooms, this is The Sun and the News of the World, appear to have been basically running little criminal gangs.
Well, I mean, the stories all seem to have a certain theme, don't they, which is that there's basically wrongdoing going on. And I think Leslie will agree, and most sensible people will agree, if people break the law, they've got to expect to be prosecuted, be they ever so mighty. And especially somebody like Mr. Murdoch, for example, if it is shown that he has broken the law, maybe he will have to go to prison so that the people who are being, the law and the value of the law is upheld in the society. I mean, we're in danger of people basically getting the view that it's all right for people to get away with it, and therefore it's all right for them to get away with it. And at a certain point, you've got to draw the line and say, no, it's not.
Yes, I mean, if they are held up and they're prosecuted, then yes, they deserve to be.
Another article relating to this is from The Guardian on the 8th of June last year, called Phone Hacking Scandal: Jonathan Rees Obtained Information Using Dark Arts. I mean, this is potentially, anyway, the network which was allegedly being used by Coulson and by Brooks, which was, interesting enough, a Freemasonic lodge where other Freemasons were recruited by this guy, a Mason called Jonathan Rees, within the police. He was then actually recruiting other public officials in the Ministry of Defence and elsewhere to supply information, confidential information, for stories at the newspaper. So pretty scary stuff there. Ultimately, Martin, what does this tell us about News International as an organisation? I understand in the US they're not prosecuting until these charges have all played out here in London. And also, of course, we got the Leveson inquiry reporting on Thursday next week.
What I want to come from Leveson, and we need to hear this, is News International, for example, gathering dirt on people, including politicians, and then if they play ball with what News International wants, that dirt never sees the light of day. But if they don't play ball, their careers are ruined. this is what I suspect has been going on. This is pretty much looks like what has been going on. And I think it's an outrage. And if we've got people running basically what is a private intelligence service in order to try and subvert democracy, I think that's just about as serious as it could get. And the sentences for those who are at the centre of it should reflect the seriousness of that.
One of the scary things about all this, of course, is that Jeremy Hunt was shown to be very much in the pocket of the Murdochs. He was Culture Secretary at the time, and in fact he obviously gave evidence to the Leveson inquiry. Now he's in charge of the National Health Service.
Yes, he is. But he hasn't been charged with anything. I have to say, I was a little bit surprised that Andrew Lansley was removed from health. He'd been through the mill with the whole thing. He knew exactly what was going on. But I'm not in Mr. Cameron's cabinet, and I cannot.
Surely.
And I really don't know.
Anyway, on a bit of a lighter note, we had the Queen in Bristol this week. Yesterday, touring around, went down to Hartcliffe, and also to the Old Vic. So let's have a listen now to part of Christina Rabina from BCFM's report down on King Street midday yesterday.
It's been an amazing morning, and surprising for me actually, because I've done other royal events, and what I found most surprising is the crowd has been so quiet. It wasn't a huge crowd. The most exciting moment for them came when the Queen came out of the Old Vic and was greeted by what looked like young naval volunteers and also children from the local primary school. But again, she didn't walk the crowd, and there were many people there with flowers, hoping that she would do the rails and that they could present them. So a pretty subdued crowd. There was many elderly people in the crowd that came from right across Bristol and South Gloucester, very, very excited. It's the first time they'd seen the Queen. The team from the Old Vic looked absolutely thrilled to bits. So all in all, it was a very good royal visit. But as I said, the thing that I found surprising was the fact that the crowd was so quiet.
The quiet crowd, for the Queen's visit. The other thing which I noticed that BBC Points West reported, but the ITV didn't, was that there was a bit of a protest too by Republicans. Sounds like a bit of a lacklustre reception for the Queen, Leslie.
Well, I think probably it was because the security was so intense. They weren't telling people where to go. A friend of mine wanted to know where she could go and watch it. I don't know. And they weren't giving that information out, so I think that's probably why it was so quiet.
Why is security so intense? Martin, any guesses?
Well, it's pretty obvious why, isn't it? I mean, we live in a dangerous world where the Queen is a potential
target. So can't she go and take flowers from people? Is it too dangerous?
Well, with precautions taken, as precautions have been taken in this case, you know.
What about the controversy over the last couple of months, though, Leslie, over the Queen phoning up the Home Secretary saying things like, why can't you arrest this guy who's a Muslim hate preacher? I mean, should she be doing that or not?
Is she?
Yeah, well, this is Frank Gardner, as from the BBC said a few weeks ago, that's exactly what she's doing. Of course, she has these confidential chats with David Cameron as well every Wednesday.
She does indeed. I would be surprised if it was quite as blatant as that, because the Queen is very diplomatic, and she might think that they ought to be doing something, but I wouldn't have thought that she would be that blatant about it.
Martin, figurehead, or is she sort of the power behind the scenes?
Well, I mean, I think that she did very well during the Olympics, and also from my own point of view, when she went to Ireland a couple of years ago, she was very, very diplomatic. That was very, very highly professional stuff. But of course, her private opinions are her private opinions, but she should keep them to herself.
Thanks very much. Thanks to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Froom Vale, Leslie Alexander. After the news, the BBC censoring whistleblowers.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, an animal welfare charity has criticised the sentence given to a circus owner found guilty of causing unnecessary suffering to an elephant. Bobby Roberts, who's 69, received a 3-year conditional discharge after the animal was filmed chained to the ground and being hit with a pitchfork. He was not banned from keeping...